Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Austin and Jim. Good to have you with us here at the beginning of the new year. As per our normal methodology, we're going to take a look back at the previous year here at the beginning of the year and talk a little bit about what's happened. Jim, what was probably the most significant thing that happened last year in our realm?
Well, I guess Osama bin Laden and the continuing decline of Al-Qaeda. What's been happening with Islamic terrorism is complicated because there's so much going on. The Islamic terrorists are becoming more localized. You know, they're basically losing their international, fervor, which was actually a unique thing back in the 1990s when bin Laden basically came up with the, brilliant idea, it was the West that was propping up all the Arab dictatorships and monarchies that the Islamic, radicals could not overcome. Obviously, the key to success was to attack the West and defeat them first, and then we can take care of their lackeys, you know, the Mubaraks and what have you. Well, we know how well that worked out. And without making a pronouncement of this change in course, they actually carried it out. I imagine that nobody wants to come out and say, hey, we're changing targets, because it's embarrassing. It's basically an admission of defeat. But as a practical matter, going international got them nowhere. And the counteroffensive is, well, basically it's killing them, literally and figuratively. I think the big news, semi-big news in last year, and probably the big news this year, is going to be what's going on in Pakistan. Basically, at the moment, and it was building up to this all throughout 2011, is we are at war, or NATO is at war with Pakistan. We ran a piece today explaining that, because the Pakistani Taliban on January 1st made a deal with the Afghan Taliban, with whom they had been feuding, or at least that on bad terms with, and the Pakistani government, or at least the Pakistani military, to declare a truce inside of Pakistan, which the Pakistanis are all for. But in return, they will be left alone so they can direct their efforts to helping their buddies in Afghanistan. So the Pakistani, and they said this point blank, so that the Pakistani and the Afghan Taliban can direct all their efforts at the NATO forces in Afghanistan. Now, one of the, I guess you could say, a big story in last year was the Taliban are being defeated in Afghanistan. Their number of attacks are down. The casualties among foreign troops are down about 20%. A lot more territory, which was once considered, you know, bandit country, you know, Taliban controlled, as it were, is no longer such. And for some reason, this didn't get a lot of publicity. But you can see the cause and effect. The Taliban and the drug gangs have been scrambling to, you know, move their activities to safer areas or other parts of Afghanistan. And now you have the Pakistani Taliban saying, hey, you know, we're willing to shut down our war with the Pakistani government, which started when the Pakistanis sided with us after 9/11, and basically go to help our fellows. Now, there's been no, as far as I can tell, there's been no official reaction from the American government yet. I imagine they're still trying to get their jaws up off the floor. And the Pakistani government has been mumbling, you know, without saying much. What they have been saying last year, and I guess this is another big story, is that they cannot control their military. I mean, they've been coming right out and saying this. For years they said, no, we are a regular country and the civilian government control the military, except when the military is running the government, which is about half the time. The civilians only got back in charge in 2008, and it's been rocky ever since. That's why the killing of bin Laden was such a big deal, not so much because this guy who'd been semi-retirement for years was finally tracked down and killed, but the fact that he was tracked down and killed in a Pakistani military town. And, oh, yes, this we mentioned, I didn't see much of it in the regular media. A former head of the Pakistani army came out and said last summer, and it took a while for it to percolate, you know, any higher, that, yes, the Pakistani military knew where bin Laden was. He wasn't sure if Musharraf knew, which, you know, shows how, you know, plausible deniability is alive and well in Pakistan. However, this guy, whose name is Butt, B-U-T-T, you find some strange, you know, old Anglo-Indian name showing up in the upper echelons of India and the and Pakistan. Anyway, he was considered the boy genius in the Pakistani army. He was eased out when Musharraf took over in 99, but disagreed with starting that little war with India over the Kargil, the Mountain Pass War, as it were. That didn't get much publicity in the West, but it was, it almost caused a major war between Pakistan and India. He sided with the civilians when the military basically told the civilian rulers, who were not in favor of this war with India, to back off. So Butt was retired, but he basically stayed in touch with all his old buddies. They still get together and play cards, I guess, regularly. And he finally came out and said, when people asked him, you know, this past summer, he was at a public function, you know, point blank, did the leadership of the military, knowing full well who he was and who his friends were, did they know about bin Laden and where he was? And he said, yes, I know at least a few did. And that's going to make headlines for some strange reason. Some people say he has a you know, an axe to grind, but not really. I mean, if you know how things operate in Pakistan, you basically put your life at risk by saying something like that. So he was sticking his neck out. But the fact of the matter is that within the Pakistani army, at least the upper echelons, from what I've been hearing, and nobody's came and given me, you know, written evidence, but, you know, the rumor mill is, yes, of course they all knew, and not all, but, you know, the key people who would have access to information like that. It was either known explicitly, or it was sort of just, you know, it rumbled down the chain of command, that, oh, yeah, you know, we're taking care of bin Laden. But, you know, Butt came out and said, you know, specifically that there were people, seen people he knew of, who knew that where he was and that he was being protected. This embarrassed the killing of bin Laden, embarrassed the Pakistani military, A, for the fact that it exposed them as liars, because for years they've been saying they had no idea where bin Laden was. And secondly, because they could not stop an invasion of Pakistan, which is basically what the, you know, the raid was. We came out and said point blank that we did not tell the Pakistanis because, well, we didn't say because we couldn't trust them, but that was implied. You know, our guys came and went, and, you know, so much for the Pakistani military. It's also become, there hasn't been an Arab Spring in Pakistan, not just because they're not Arabs, but because the Pakistani military has been very successful at setting up India as the big bad, you know, the enemy who's just about to invade us at any moment. But what happened last year, and this is a big story, which is sort of an ephemeral, you know, a story that's hard to get your arms around, it's become more and more talked about in the Pakistani media that India doesn't want to invade Pakistan. Now, this is considered heresy, and there have been complaints in the Pakistani media that the army is again killing journalists who say things the army doesn't like. Now, the army didn't kill journalists up until 2008 because they ran the government and they could basically, you know, just give you a tap on the shoulder and you would get the message right away. But once the civilians took over, a lot of journalists began to think, hey, we don't have to be afraid of the military anymore. While the military last year was reminding there were a lot of dead journalists and a lot who were roughed up or simply threatened. And the problem is, the threats aren't working. I mean, it's shutting up some journalists, but between the internet and a lot of journalists, just, you know, the hell with it. There are a lot of Pakistanis who want to change. And the military is scared. They have a good thing going. They're basically one of those situations where it's an army with a country attached. And they don't want to lose all their privileges and all their money and all their goodies. And now they've decided to basically go to war with the United States and NATO. Or at least threaten to. I mean, they've cut off our supply since last November when there was that border incident, where they accused America of attacking, deliberately attacking the Pakistani army again. The American diplomats have sort of, you know, tried to keep it low key, but that's where it stands right now. Now, the Pakistanis haven't tried to deny us air access. And they know full well that, you know, stopping truck traffic, by the way, just recently the trucks were told to turn around and go back to Karachi. Stuff is going to be sent through the northern network because most of the supplies for the last year or so have been coming in from the north through Central Asia, the Caucasus. We have three different routes, you know, we're using. Apparently they're hustling, they're speeding up the switch within, by this year, I think, by the end of this year, we did several pieces on this. 90% of the ground, supplemented by ground, is supposed to come in through the north, not through Pakistan. The Pakistanis are trying to strong arm us, and it's unclear exactly where that all is going to end.
Austin, what's your take on what the most important thing of last year was?
Well, I think Jim touches on the, from our strategy page perspective, the most important complex issue of Pakistan and also how Bin Laden fits into it. That kind of segues into something that's been, I think, extremely important in 2011. That was Arab Spring. Al-Qaeda had so little to say and do about Arab Spring, the revolts against the a variety, actually, of Arab dictatorships. I mean, there are four different flavors that were really under siege in the dictatorships along the Mediterranean littoral, and I'm talking Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Syria, in order, and of course the revolt in Yemen, it's labeled in some circles, major media call it a Arab Spring revolt. I'm not quite sure it fits in with the ones in the Mediterranean because, and I don't mean to say this sarcastically or cynically, it's just a fact, Yemen is always in some stage of revolt, and there was a case where it was. Some of what was going on was exacerbated, but not caused by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And we've been covering Yemen on strategy page for years, and you have, in particular in eastern Yemen, among some of the tribes out there, heavens, there are a couple of tribes that are still nominally royalist, looking for the old Yemeni nobility to return, and there are tribes out there that there are even Shia tribes to go with some of the Sunnis that are in perpetual rebellion against Sana. And then Bahrain, which was a revolt against, well, the regime in Bahrain is a Sunni royal regime, and Bahrain is about 70-75% Shia. What was more curious about it was we never quite got a grip on how involved Iran was in that because poking Bahrain is a way to poke Saudi Arabia, and that's something the Iranians are certainly deeply involved in. Anyway, talking through it, I think the four primary Arab Spring revolutions are a huge event. As I've said before, I believe there was a strategy talk that we had in June or July, Dan, where I said I don't think we're going to know what the real result for another 20 or 30 years, and maybe 40 years. But revolts in these places, the one in Syria, it's been brewing, and you can't simply say it's been brewing for 30 years because you can look back and see some of the issues that are broached were exit in the early 70s as well. So maybe 40 years in the case of Syria. It ties into a grievance or an identity issue that Al-Qaeda certainly exploited successfully in the 90s and the early part of the last decade. How does a culturally Islamic society respond to modernity? And I think this begs the definition of modernity, which I've said is a fuzzy concept, but the way Al-Qaeda framed it and other apologists for the Al-Qaeda type violence is that it's, you know, this is all an impingement from the imperialist or infidel or whatever, the West. Let's take the war to the West. Jim spoke about that. He touched on that, talking about Al-Qaeda's decision to go international. It just didn't work well for him. Well, the truth of the matter is, and we've talked about this in past strategy talks, is that a lot of the issues are actually, well, they're local or issues within Muslim societies. I won't say Muslim culture. That's just as fragmented as everybody else's. But within Muslim societies, and one of the startling things to me out of Arab Spring 2011 was the fact that you had significant numbers of people, in some cases the majority of countries, where they people coming out saying, look, these are our problems. Some, you know, can say are ancillary to things that have happened in the past, but we're going to act ourselves to deal with these problems and not blame somebody in London, somebody in Paris, somebody in Washington, not blame Hollywood or whatever, or like this. That's a change. Now, that's the kind of things that of comments that I myself have heard in what I call second and third day conversations. The first day, you hear, you know, oh, you evil American infidels and the like, but by the third day, you reach the point, well, how do you guys do it? What is it we need to do? That kind of thing. Well, Arab Spring 2011 was the blossoming of the third day conversations in the Middle East and the expression of it. Not resolved. There are a lot of identity issues with it. That's one of the Muslim identity issues at play when you hear, see the success of some of the Muslim Brotherhood parties in Egypt. And those are results that are not, in my view, beneficial to Egypt in terms of modernizing their society. I don't think I know darn well they don't forward American or Western European political goals or aspirations for the Egyptians. But in context, they're understandable. They're very understandable. It's something that's going to have to be accommodated through their political system and, you know, since the systems are so shaky, through their political experience might even be a better way to put it. And how that this evolves is what I mean when we're not going to know what the results are for, you know, two or three, four decades. The 2011 Arab Spring was a moment where a lot of this is revealed. And not only revealed, it's rhetorically, it's revealed in action, and it sort of ties in this when Jim was talking about Al-Qaeda as the phenomenon. Al-Qaeda in this way was the ultimate, you know, grievance, special interest, that it's all the fault of the outsider and we'll wage war with the outsider, just come along with us. Well, guess what? That's another one of Al-Qaeda's flaws, and Arab Spring exposed it, which is, no, it's not the outsider's fault, it's We're to some degree responsible for our own destiny. I'll make a comment too about Pakistan. I think a lot of Pakistanis are waking up to that as well. They've known it for a long time, but that comes into the discussion that Jim was referring to in the Pakistani media. But oh, wait a minute, maybe the Indians really aren't going to invade us. Maybe they really don't want to. Maybe that's a ginned up deal because we're failing and they're succeeding. But just make this observation with something else we've discussed. The Indians really, really wanted to invade Pakistan. Not that they want to go take over the cities, but really deal them a blow. They have such an overwhelming military capacity that they probably could do it, at least on a border-type strike or a strike to damage the Pakistani military. But they don't. They don't for a number of reasons. For one, it's a stupid policy. Damage themselves politically, but they do have that power, and they're not exercising. And there's some Pakistanis that have come to realize that. The other thing, and this is something that we write about constantly in the wars around the world section on the Balkans, that I think I can safely say this, that Jim and I are both kind of fascinated by the Balkans. Anybody that's interested in European history can't help but in some way be saying, look at this place, you know, what a continuing mess, 300 years of a continuing mess. But this situation with Greece, and that's the exposure of this is more economics, but it certainly moves into geopolitical outcomes and instability, and that's Greece's spending other people's money, endemic corruption to the, you know, constant tax evasion, corrupt public officials, corrupt businesses, and it's exacerbated the economic problems that the country has. And I think, and I argued this in a recent newspaper column, the On Point column, that Greece represents or suggests some things that you would see if there really were an extended and prolonged deep recession or even a global depression. You see a weak governments getting weaker, more violence, potential of a coup, and of course you've got your radicals in Greece, and in the column I mentioned specifically Marxist radicals, but there can be other types of radicals of any stripe that see the government's weakness and the anger of the population as the ultimate opportunity, this crisis we're going to take advantage of. And the left in Greece, even 3 years ago, when riots broke out after, now Jim, I know we wrote about this. This was when a student was killed by the cops in like 2008.
And
here a bunch of the anarchists came out because, hey, this is an opportunity to launch the revolution, you know, and then on top of that, you start getting the economic issues are coming, the bills are finally coming due, and you can't hide the bills. A group of anarchists and the hard left said, you know, we're going to use this. Now's the time for the revolution. Well, you'd see that extended in whatever a small state or medium-sized state was going through a prolonged economic depression. And I think that's not a particularly a 2011 story, Dan, because we can look at the roots going back to 2009. It's a 2009, 2010, 2011, and could be a story given some the things that, for instance, I know that Jim's discussed this, how long it takes actually to write or refloat a sinking economic ship. I guess that's a better way to put it. They're looking at it. Greece is looking at extended austerity for 5, 6, 10 years. I don't know. It's not something that is resolved within 3 or 4 years of politicians making promises. I mean, their options are bad, more bad and worse and worst. And just taking Greece as the example, you could see this as a potential that other states face if they, you know, once they start running out of their, of other people's money, or in the Greek case, they've run out of the money loaned to them by the French and Germans.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good wrap-up, gentlemen. I think what we'll do next time is we'll talk a little bit about the coming year, even though we've touched on it a little bit. There are some other questions I have about the coming year. So we'll end it there.
Well, Dan, let me make one other point on this. So I think it's,
okay.
It's one of the things on the strategy page. A lot of these things, you know, they don't ever quite end, despite what people
say. That's right.
They don't ever. Here I am talking about the Balkans in 2012. Jim, I'm throwing it to you. What happened in 1912 in the Balkans?
There was wars and threats of bigger wars. See, nothing seems to have changed. Yeah, I think there was the second Balkan War in the umpteenth series. It's hard to keep track.
Well, there you are. It's the first Balkan War, and then we get the second Balkan War in 1913.
And we get the big Balkan War.
And then they call it World War One in 1914. So there's some things here, Dan, that even though this is the way that the media shapes it, let's talk about last year and then this year, but we're talking about some things that are really, really multi-year. Okay.
That's right. All right. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
We'll see you guys. Bye.